my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Change it.
Turn and face the strain.
Change it.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
Change it.
Turn and face the strain.
Change
it. He's gonna have to see it.
Hi there, my name's Casey Criswell. You may recognize me from Internet's Midnight Munster podcast and the Bloody Good Horror podcast. And I'm here today to host a show for you. You may have thought we're gone, folks, but guess what? Not quite. We're still here, by God. It's Midnight Munster number 16. After a lengthy hiatus with real life polluting the airways and stifling our creativity, we're back. And we got a hell of a show for you, the folks. This week we're going to be covering Pulse 2, not starring Kristen Bell, much to my chagrin, as well as 1980's The Changeling, starring George C. Scott. So, we have a couple of movies, one not so scary, one pretty damn scary, so stay tuned and listen to hear about that. I'll be joined by none other than Colleen Criswell, also of Internet's Midnight Munster podcast, and it's going to be a fun time, and we're happy to be back. We hope that you are happy to have us back. So be sure to let us know, folks, because we need feedback. We thrive on it. We feed on it, and we don't get shit. So be sure to let us know. Get in touch with us. Send us an email at cinemafromage@gmail.com. And as always, be sure to check out the website at www.cinemafromage.com for all sorts of reviews and horror stuff. Cinema Fromage and myself was recently invited to join the League of Tana Tea Drinkers, a Unity blog put on by many high-level horror bloggers across the internet. It is quite the honor for me, and I hope they appreciate my participation, because I am quite excited to be there with them, with many other illustrious blogs such as Zombo's Closet of Horror, The Groovy Age of Horror, and all sorts of good stuff. So be sure to check out the League of Tana Tea Drinkers. You can find the link and logo on cinemafromage.com, of course. And once again, let us know that you're happy to hear us back, or if you'd rather stay underneath our rock. Again, that's cinemafromage@gmail.com. So in the meantime, be sure to check out my other writing at www.bloodygoodhorror.com, where I have weekly reviews, blog posts, and all sorts of stuff pertaining to horror movies, as well as the weekly Bloody Good Horror podcast, where I am joined by none other than Mark and Eric Newell and John Schnars. So here we go, folks. Again, tune in, stay tuned, settle back, and sit down and shut up, because here comes Pulse 2 and The Changeling.
Much. It hurts because I love you so much. It's okay. It's okay, baby. Come on. It's okay, baby. It's okay.
Shot in 2008, the sequel to 2006's Kristen Bell starring feature Pulse, the story of ghosts coming to us through the wireless airwaves from all of our wireless connections, because technology is evil. Now we have Pulse 2, directed by Joel Soisson, who happened to be the producer of the original Pulse. He is now directing and writing Pulse 2. And keeping things going, he is also known for directing The Prophecy Forsaken and The Prophecy Uprising, as well as Maniac Cop 3. Pulse 2, according to IMDb, promises to be the first of two planned sequels to the original Pulse. And unfortunately for us, we're not quite sure what warranted Pulse a sequel in the first place, because the first one was lousy.
Yes. Yes, it was. There was... My main... I mean, for the most part, I don't even know where to start with this. the storyline goes... You know, it follows along the same idea that through the internet, through these webcams, we have people who are committing suicide, and all of that negativity kind of leaks out, and these spirits are now being, you know, kind of stuck in between life and the afterlife.
Right, and this one, too, is pretty much a departure from the original, and to some ways, you can almost pretend like the original didn't exist. I mean, you're not going to get the full explanation while the ghosts were there, but it's really a completely different movie than the first one was. And
right, because the first one all had to do with a specific program, a, you know, a CD.
It started out with the, yeah, with the virus or something stupid like that.
Yeah. This one doesn't really go into that sort of thing. It just says that it's somehow transmitted through chat rooms and websites and whatnot. So pretty much laptops and computers.
Well,
are...
it's the evolution of the original concept.
Yeah. So it's like everyone.
The initial infection is done. This is now the after effects of it and whatnot. We see more of the view from the digital ghost side of life than we d- and then mixed in with ours, kind of what they're going through a little bit more. And we also get to see the start of survival after the fact.
Right.
Because now it's starting to progress a little bit more further into this, your typical like zombie apocalypse type flick where you're starting to see refugee cities are starting to form up and whatnot. And the rumors of, per IMDb, the next movie is going to be Pulse 3 Invasion, which is going to surround the fact that it's going to be based on one of these refugee cities, and a certain citizen of the city who is now a teenager and decides to go back to the city for a life of her own.
Oh, okay.
Yes. They actually tie in
they tie
quite
in.
Well.
So they tie this movie into the next sequel. Okay. There is a character at the very beginning of the film. You see him all dressed up in the whole red thing, because that's the whole thing. They cannot go through the
red
ghosts.
Is the one frequency that they can't penetrate.
Yeah, the ghosts can't penetrate the red frequency. So there's this guy walking around in this whole red costume. You know, great glasses. He looked like a Klan member who fell into a vat of, you know, red jello.
And that's the whole opening sequence of the movie, is him getting all this suit on.
Yeah, and... Okay, so we see him at the beginning of the movie, and then it cuts to the storyline of the woman who can't find her daughter, and her very dusty apartment. And then, we don't see this guy again until later on, where the father and daughter are trying to escape and he carjacks them. And then we never see him again.
Well, in their defense, from what I've been reading on this, this is actually, this and the third movie were actually shot back to back, and they're supposed to be coming out somewhat close to each other, I guess. Okay. And I have a feeling he's going to play into a factor in the next movie.
In the next movie. Okay, I would hope so, because otherwise...
Which, as it's presented, is lousy, because what if the funding drops through and they never get the distribution for the third movie or something like that? You've got this guy that's thrown in there for no freaking reason whatsoever.
Yeah,
except
he's useless.
He just tells us that red's important again, which we already know from the first movie, as well as the
and he gets a little piece of something. He gets, because he convinces...
It's some kind of microprocessor because he's got something... He's got an idea that's going to save the world from all these digital ghosts.
He said it's either going to save the world or destroy them all, and then we never hear from him again.
Right.
So it's like, okay, well, that was interesting.
Now, this movie definitely has some problems, and though it's not saying much, though, at the same time, this movie is a hell of a lot better than the first one was.
Yes.
And that's saying a lot for me because the first one starred Kristen Bell. And that's a whole different conversation and argument between Colleen and I.
Yeah.
But no, the movie does have its benefits and it's got its high points. There's some good stuff here. It's just kind of... unfortunately, it's attached to the first movie that came out, Pulse 1. It's attached to that, which gives it pulls it down some. And it's kind of slow in spots.
It's slow in spots. They leave way too much open. And considering now we have to wait now for this third installment, it makes a lot of it just almost senseless. It real unless both of them were actually going to be released
right
soon
I
after,
agree with that,
or if they gave more hints.
I agree with that, and unfortunately, too, though, the odd thing is that all the information about Pulse 3 is in the IMDb page for Pulse 2. There is not a separate page for it, so that does not bode well for the future. Now, we can hope that once the third movie comes out that it's going to be one hell of a movie, it's going to blow our minds, but once you see all the parts come together as a whole, but I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah, that's going to be something that you would actually have to watch maybe 2 and 3 together to even make sense of 2. I mean, there was a storyline. There was a storyline, and had they just stuck to that storyline instead of trying to throw in, you know, these things that are going to confuse us since we don't know there's a third movie, had they used that portion where he runs into the, you know, guy in red, and they used that as a maybe a flashback in 3, that would have been made more sense to me.
Right. And now we go through this movie, though, like I said, there's just many good things. There's some great shots in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Joel Soisson, like I said, was just a producer for the first movie. He wasn't a director. He comes in, and the first movie is a remake of a Japanese movie anyways. And I don't think this movie has, from what I can tell from the research, has any connection whatsoever to any of the Japanese flicks. I haven't seen him, so I couldn't say for sure, but I'm pretty positive it doesn't have anything to do with it. Anyways, though, Joel Soisson comes through, and he's directing this. He's got some great cinematography going on here, and there's some great shots moved in. There's some good gore. It's all pretty heavily CGI'd, which is not necessarily a good thing, but some of the stuff is they come out cool in their individual performances, I guess.
Right.
There's a bit with an Uncle Pete in the room with his cat, and the whole thing with the red thing there. You can imagine how it goes through. That was done fairly well. It was pretty gruesome to watch. The bit with the dad's girlfriend Marta, who's played by Bonnie Bliss, who shows up, and when she gets infected, the whole scene with her and the fat dude from the village.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty cool as she started
doing it.
That was
cool. I think probably, and you missed the shot. I felt so bad that you missed the shot because you had gone into the kitchen to grab something to drink. There was there's a portion at the very beginning where the father has come to find his daughter, and the daughter was staying with her mother. The father and mother were divorced, and he can't find the daughter, and he finds out that his ex-wife had a blog. So he's sitting there reading the blog, but over his shoulder you see her shadow talking as he's reading it. So it's like she's actually saying the stuff to him, and it is the most beautiful shot I had ever seen in a very long time in a horror film.
Now, there's a lot of good aspects, too, plot-wise, in the way they handle things, because, like I said before, we get to see a lot of the world on the digital ghost side of things, on their side of life, and you see what's going on there. These are intertwined fairly well, that for a while you don't know for sure what's going on.
Right. You kind of have an idea, but you're not quite sure what's real, what isn't real. Who's alive? Who's dead? It gets kind of confusing at first, but I think, you know, where you were talking about the CGI gore and the CGI shots, I thought that it kind of worked well with the theme. Because the entire movie being about the whole
digital thing. That's true. I didn't even think of it in that aspect.
That, you know, the whole... I mean, because some of the CGI shots were so evidently CGI shots, but at the same time, it was supposedly a whole shift in the person's reality because they're being chased by a digital creature.
Right. And some of it, it's pretty obvious that the actors themselves superimposed over CGI screens, too. You see that a lot with Michelle, the wife, or the mother, throughout the beginning of the movie, which does play in well to the plot.
Right. And, like, when the fat guy's running from, you know, naked digital ex-girlfriend chick who's chasing after him, all of a sudden you can tell he's in front of a, you know, it's all... The entire background seems to be digital.
Right. Now, this movie here stars Jamie Bamber, who you will know as Lee Adama from Battlestar Galactica. He is our main lead throughout this movie. He does an okay job. He's a little over the top and a little over dramatic, I would say.
Yeah.
In a good chunk of this movie, and his hairdo is downright laughable. It cracks me up throughout the whole movie, especially after seeing him for so long. About the only thing I, you know, knowing him in for so long is being Battlestar Galactica. It's a pretty funny change. And actually looking on IMDb, because I have not watched all of Battlestar Galactica, you can kind of see where the hairstyle in this movie is just a tweaked version of his later hairstyle in Battlestar Galactica, so they didn't screw up his character in that with the costuming. But he does a passable job. He is nowhere near as good as what he is on BSG, because like I said, he is very over dramatic at parts, almost like he's trying too hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then, other than that, though, I mean, it's okay. He doesn't take away from it necessarily. You're gonna find yourself rolling your eyes at some of it. He was more over the top towards the beginning of the movie. As the movie rolled on, you could tell that he was feeling a little more comfortable with the role, and it started to come a little bit more natural. It was about the time that his girlfriend Marta showed up at his cabin that you could tell he started to feel a little bit more natural, and that could be from the writing too, because his dialogue became a little bit more snarky as he was fighting with his girlfriend and whatnot.
Yeah.
And fighting with the people in his little village out in the woods and whatnot. And then you could tell he was feeling a little bit more natural, and the character started to become a little bit more believable. The whole bit in the beginning with him trying to find his daughter, when he finds his daughter dealing with his wife and whatnot, that stuff has just seemed like it was not good.
Yeah. I agree.
Also starring in this movie, we have, like I mentioned before, Bodhi Bliss, who's been in quite a few TV shows that you would recognize, such as... there's been a couple CSI Miamis. She plays Maxine Valera. Let's see. She was the hooker in National Lampoon Presents Dorm Days. She's been in Bubble Boy, Charmed, Freaky Lynx, if you can remember that show. That's a whole nother episode there, because I bet that's coming out on DVD soon. And you know what? I feel bad that Ethan Embry's career has fallen off the deep end as it has, and he's now relegated back to bit parts again. But that's another story.
Well, it looks from looking at the list here, a lot of these characters that they're talking about being in Pulse 2 are not, because I'm looking here and it's saying that, because it has Carly Scott Collins, who played Justine in Pulse 2, but then again, there's another Justine credit for Brittany Renee Finnemore, and I can only guesstimate that, considering looking at the young woman, this is going to be Justine in Pulse 3.
Right. See, and that's what we really need cleared up on this. So if anybody has any information on how they're going to handle this with the Pulse sequels, because it's very odd, because if you look under the plot synopsis for Pulse 2 Afterlife, there's listed two movies underneath the synopsis for Pulse 2. The first sequel is titled Pulse Afterlife. The second sequel is titled Pulse Invasion. It is now 7 years later, and the survivors on Earth have settled into a primitive lifestyle completely void of electronics. The clusters of human survivors live together in refugee camps as the phantoms have taken over the cities. Justine is now a teenager, and she escapes to the city to try and make a life for herself where she is not a drain on her adopted family. Now, where Pulse 2 ended, it segues perfectly into this Pulse Invasion, but there is no information whatsoever that exists on Pulse Invasion or Pulse 3.
Yeah.
It's all tied into the same page as this, and like Colleen said, there's even actor listings in here. In this listing for Pulse 2, for people that are credited for Pulse 3.
Right.
And it does not show up anywhere in this movie. And there's no announcements of a Pulse 3 as well, so that's where it gets confusing and becomes a mystery. So if you do have any information on that, if you happen to be a filmmaker or if you happen to be in the know, send us an email, cinemafromage@gmail.com, because I'm curious to know.
As am I, because otherwise it's just all too confusing for me.
There you go, folks. That is Pulse 2 Afterlife, directed by Joel Soisson, the sequel to 2006's Pulse, starring Jamie Bamber.
Within this old house live two residents. One of them is John Russell, composer, professor. The other has been dead for over 70 years.
Claire, I'd like to talk to you about the house.
Did you die in this house? How did you die?
Whatever it is trying desperately to communicate. What is it in that house, Claire? What is it doing? Why is it trying to reach me?
It's a hand.
Something of the senators.
The year was 1980. The star was George C. Scott in this telling of The Changeling, a haunted house tale about a man, George C. Scott, who is a famous composer / college professor whose family was killed in a horrible accident with a truck on an icy road.
Not to be confused with the new movie out.
Correct. This has absolutely jack shit to do with Angelina Jolie's new movie called The Changeling. So this one's all new. George C. Scott takes on a new professorship at a university in Seattle, moves out there, rents a huge old estate for himself so he can work on his composing. And as he goes and starts his composing, I've got Monty Python's Decomposing Composers now stuck in my head. Anyways, he realizes that there's something else going on in the house.
Yeah, he starts hearing weird noises. There's like this big clanging that happens every morning at 6 a.m. You know, he has the water heater checked out. And
faucets turning on their own.
He sees things. He hears things. His daughter's ball keeps bouncing around.
We'll get into that later. So and then eventually as him and his very affectionate realtor starts to dig deeper into the mystery, they find out that there might be a cover-up going on here with this house and the family that's involved, which happens to be the family of a senator from national senator from Seattle. Alrighty, so as we dig in here, this one, like we said, stars George C. Scott, and there's really nobody can question the fact that George C. Scott was a master actor stood so far above anybody else. And it's really not, you can't even question it at this point in his career by the time 1980 come around, because he'd already done The Exorcist as far as horror goes, and not to mention Patton and everything else that he's been in.
Right. He's an excellent actor. He was married to Colleen Dewhurst, excellent actress. Their son is Campbell Scott, and their son's Campbell Scott. Acting is a huge thing for this man. He was excellent in everything he did.
Right.
He
has done quite a bit of horror. But what I say too, though, by the time The Changeling came out in 1980, this man, you don't even question the man's portfolio is so high and his performances are so high that you don't even question the fact if he's going to be good in the movie or not.
Right.
You just know that he's going to be.
Classically trained. He was always wonderful in everything he did.
Right.
Other than Changeling and, of course, Exorcist, he was in Murders in the Rue Morgue, which is one of my favorite ones that he's done. He just has that whole, I don't know, he's a formidable actor. He's one of those people who you just look at him and you know he's so dead serious in everything he does.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's amazing to watch him.
Now, as far as The Changeling goes, the movie itself is a different type of horror flick. It's very cerebral, it's very slow-moving, it's very atmospheric. But at the same time, it's also a very, very excellent scary movie, a very excellent haunted house movie.
Right. This is a haunted house film. This isn't a slasher film. This isn't a blood and gore film. This isn't, you know, your typical 80s horror film. This is actually a psychological thriller more than anything else. It has a lot of mystery to it, and the whole mood that it sets. If you noticed with like the shots that were made, a lot of them were from the ground up and at awkward angles, which really, you know, skewed your view and made you kind of woozy while watching it, which was wonderful.
Yeah. Now, this movie, though, there is some... To be honest, yeah, and now when we watched this weekend, I had never seen this movie before myself. I don't think you have either.
I had never seen it either. I saw it on Netflix. It was a recommendation to me from Netflix, and so I thought,
it's one I've seen many times floating around too, though, but you never see that many people talking about it. And now this movie is the first movie in a long time that actually scared the shit out of me a couple times over.
Yes, it did. It's very, you know, interesting when you're sitting next to somebody who usually through a horror film just sits there or goes, huh, or giggles like a schoolgirl, to actually have him jump
and yell, oh shit, out of nowhere.
Even at points where one point was when he sees the bathtub and all of a sudden you see the silhouette of a person.
That was so masterfully done.
And Casey and I both jumped at that point, but there was another part, nothing happened and he still jumped. And it really impresses me when a movie can do that to you. It tells me, okay, this is obviously a really good film if you're actually jumping.
I don't get scared too much anymore watching these movies. Obviously, I watch a shitload of them. I don't get too scared anymore unless it involves spiders.
Yeah, because that was another big, huge thing when he goes up to the... up to a turret room in the very top of this house, and, you know, the... door, there's a door there, but it has had, you know, wooden planks and shelving attached to it. So he tears that down, and then, you know, he's trying to pry open the door. He can't get the door open. Then all of a sudden, the door just opens, and it's thick with cobwebs. In case he's like, hell no, I'd be like, turn around, go the other way.
Not going to happen. And yes, folks, if you're listening to this, I have seen the picture from Australia of the spider eating a bird. No, I don't want to see it again. So this movie, though, it's well written as well. It's a very slow movie. It's very, to some extent, it's very reminiscent of the old Hammer horror movies in feel and pace, but it actually takes itself more seriously, and it's actually more, to some extent, better done than a horror flick or a Hammer flick, because it's actually more scary.
Right. Well, it has that sense of reality to it, whereas the Hammer horror is usually bigger than life. This was quite a bit more subdued.
Yeah.
It was the average guy you know, he just lost his wife and daughter 4 months ago. He's now trying to pick up the pieces, and all of a sudden he stumbles into this huge thing. And it's like, you know, when it rains, it pours. You feel so bad for this guy because he's just gotten over such tragedy of losing his family, and now he's trying to pick all that up, and now he's, you know, pretty much stuck in the middle of another tragedy where a child was killed, and the whole mystery surrounding that. And it was very, you know, and there were red herrings through the whole thing, and you think that it's, you know, going to be this other person, and it's just, it's amazing how they did it.
And they keep you guessing throughout the entire movie, and they keep the twists and turns coming so well.
Yeah, and it was one of those things where if it didn't have that, I would have been asleep.
Right.
Because it is so slow-paced, and it's so, you know, okay, it's an 80s, you know, early 80s, late 70s style film, and yeah, big house, yeah, a ghost, blah, 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 yeah, I know where this is going, but you don't, and it's like, wait a minute, I wasn't expecting that, and that's, you know, something that I absolutely love in my ghost stories. You don't get that enough anymore.
Now, another thing adding to this movie with the creepiness and the atmosphere of this movie is actually the sound in this movie is so excellent, especially for a movie coming from the 80s. Mm-hmm. The sound effects in here, especially anything involving the ghost, there's throughout the movie you'll hear different various noises going on throughout this huge mansion. And there, you know, which adds to, you know, especially once you know that there's something going on there, then you start hearing things like footsteps or doors closing far off in this mansion. You know something's up. And that first time after he had his students out there working on a symphony with him, and they all leave, and then he hears the faucet in the sink turn on, he closes that off, and then he hears a faucet 3 floors up in the mansion that hasn't been restored, hasn't been cleaned out or anything, turn on.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't even been up to that part of the building yet.
Right.
And whatnot. And just the dread that makes you feel, when combined with the fact that you're sucked into the fact that this is Joe Average that Colleen was talking about, a normal man that you can identify with, and you could just imagine yourself in that. It's very easy to slip into imagining yourself in that role of, if you heard that noise, that water turn on 3 floors above, just what the hell are you going to do?
Right.
And, of course, George C. Scott's man enough that he walks right up into it. And Colleen had mentioned his daughter's, the writing is done well, too. Colleen had mentioned earlier the thing about his daughter's ball. There's a scene at the very beginning of the movie after the accident, and he's having, he's kind of thinking back memories over stuff as they're packing up his apartment. And they show a scene in the room where the daughter runs in, has this rubber bouncy ball, and throws it in the room. Or throws it to him trying to play catch, and it happened just before she died. And then he'd found the ball again, and he'd taken it and set it in a desk that was in the room in New York or wherever they're at. So they get to the house, and he has this desk has been moved out there to this mansion that he's renting. He pulls the ball out or finds it there and leaves it in the desk. Well, then later that night, he's sitting in the study after all the spooky stuff start happening, and you start to hear the rubber bouncing ball bouncing throughout the dark shadows of the mansion and coming down the stairs.
And you have to also keep in mind that the stairs, this place is like 4 stories tall.
Yeah, and this thing just bouncing down the stairs, and you don't see it, you don't see the ghost, you don't see anything, but it's terrifying because you can picture yourself sitting there, and what are you going to do if you hear that noise? And then there's another point where he disposes of the ball and gets rid of it deliberately.
Yeah, he takes it, throws it over the...
He goes into town and throws it into a river miles and miles away from the mansion. He gets home, and here it comes again, the thwack, thwack, thwack down
and
the stairs.
It comes right back, and it's like, you know, to me, it
and it's as soon as he comes in.
Yeah, as soon as he comes
and
in.
It
just brought to mind Fido to me.
Yeah.
We're being tortured by the, you know, ghost dog. Oh, I found the ball!
And it was at this point in the movie, I turned to Colleen, to, you know, when especially after he's thrown the ball in the river, and he comes home, and it's bouncing down the stairs right away as soon as he walks in the door. It's like, fuck that. Yeah. I'm gone. So there's a lot of little things like that. And there's even points, too, where another thing that keeps you jumping and guessing, at least for me, that worked well, is they show a lot of things, a lot of the characters' reactions to things off screen.
Mm-hmm.
That they don't show you, but you can see their fear and terror, and all you can do is sit there. It makes your hairs raise on end because you're wondering if they're going to show it and how horrible is it going to be.
Right, because you're like, you know, you're seeing their horror, And then, you know, and by today's standards, what, because there were a couple times like where the woman finally hears, because they have a seance and they record it with one of those wonderful old reel-to-reel recorders that they had back in that day. And I, you know, it brought back memories to me when I was little and I used to play spy with my dad's old reel-to-reel. But it was, for me, this was, what I found so interesting was that, you know, even before, you know, EVPs were such a popular phenomenon where, you know, ghost hunters and, you know, white noise and all that, and they're all talking about the EVPs and stuff, here he record, you know, he's recording the seance and he's playing it back and he's catching all of these EVPs of this boy who has died, and they're trying to, you know, find out what happened to him and everything. And I mean, it, she's listening to this and she's come, you know, she's like, I don't know what to do about this, this is just crazy. And she goes back out to the foyer and she looks up and just this, you know, I thought she was going to start screaming, but she didn't. It's like when the screams caught in your throat because you know you see something that you shouldn't be seeing. And it, they pan to it, and all she sees is one little thing. And it, you know, it's so jarring at that point because, you know, you don't know what to think of, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Just
it's
one thing that normally wouldn't be scary.
And it's not what you expected to see either.
Right.
When they finally pan the camera. And this movie is so great for that. And it's, it ties back to the old theory that you never show the monster.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of filmmakers that subscribe to that theory. And this is proof that it works, because when they do,
your imagination is going to be much scarier than anything.
Exactly,
that's
exactly it. Your imagination is much scarier. They do such a great job, makes the movie far more scary when you don't see things. And when they do show you glimpses of things here, the movie lacks for it.
You think so?
There's a point where towards the end of the movie where the woman starts getting chased upstairs,
mm-hmm.
and that. At that point, it becomes, you get to see what is the manifestation of what's going on in this house, and it becomes a little zany.
Well, yeah, that part was kind of laughable.
Whereas before, you didn't get that much of a view as to what was going on to this house. You didn't get to actually see something tangible.
It wasn't so aggressive.
And that made it all the scarier.
Well, part of me, I could, I mean, with, part of me with this movie kept thinking upon, wow, how stupid can some people be? Because throughout the entire film, the ghost has told you what it wants, and
right.
nobody gave the ghost what it wants.
Exactly.
And it was like, you know, have you just given this poor ghost this one thing that he was asking for, none of this bad stuff would have probably happened, and he would have been happy and would have gone into the light. But oh no! Let's go and, you know, chase after somebody else for a while and, you know, yell at them and give them this object that needs to be given to the ghost.
Yes.
Instead of giving it to the ghost. Even though the ghost has said it, like, five times and over and over and over, and I can still hear his little whiny voice in my head. And, you know, so you kind of feel bad for the ghost for not getting what he wanted. And, you know, to me, that part just annoyed the hell out of me, because I hate it when you know what needs to be done, why don't you just do it type thing. And granted, yeah, if he had just done it, it would have, you know, cut, what, 10-20 minutes off the movie.
Yeah.
And the house might not have burnt down, and, you know, everybody might not have, you know, gone and gotten killed or something. Had they just said, okay, here you go. But it, to me, that sort of thing just drives me insane in any movie, though, if people are so stupid that they don't, you know, follow through with what they need to do. But all in all, this movie was just, it's different. It's not going to be one of those films that, you know, tosses on buckets of blood. There's no boobs. There's no, there's really no profanity except for, you know, the one time when he comes in and he starts hearing the pounding again and he's like, you son of a bitch! But,
and he drops a D-bomb.
Yeah.
What do you want? Damn it!
Yeah. But other than that, you know, and the costumes, of course, because it's from the late 70s, early 80s are just so hysterical to think how bad fashion was then.
Yeah, especially when the realtor lady showed up in jodhpurs and riding boots.
Well, she was going riding, though.
Still, though.
She was going riding.
People don't wear that shit to go out riding in the woods just
not
for shits
anymore,
and giggles.
But maybe in the late 70s they did. It was still fashionable.
So, yes, there you have it, folks. The Changeling is a different movie as far as horror goes. It's going to be more cerebral. It's going to be slow. So bear with it when you first kick in. It's going to get better, I promise you. For me, I'm going to give this one probably an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I'll give it a good 8 out of 10 also.
It's a very solid 8 out of 10. It's a very creepy movie, and it's way better than I expected it to be from, you know, looking at the original.
Right. And it, you know, it's one of those films that you need to sit and watch and think about it. It's not one of those that just going to be hacking up people and, you know.
Exactly. And remember, folks, this is a movie without blood, gore, or jump scares. People jumping out of shadows or wearing a hockey mask. And if it can make me say, oh, shit, it's got something going for it.
Sides, but never leave the stream of warm and permanent sand. So the days float through my eyes, but still the days seem the same. And these children that you spit on as they try to change their worlds are immune to your consultations. They're quite aware of what they're going through.
Changes. Turn and face the strange.
Changes.
Don't tell them to grow up and out of it.